once you're an adult, your relationship with your parents is a choice. And once your kids are adults, your relationship with your kids is a choice. You no longer need each other in any sort of real way. It's an opportunity that carries with it risks and obligations and pitfalls and all that. And certainly there's something to be missed if it's not there, but it's not existential.
Hello, everyone. I'm Denise Gorin. Welcome to Bite Your Tongue, the podcast. Thanks for joining us as we speak with experts, authors, parents, and even young adults to explore the transition from parenting our young children to building healthy relationships with our now adults. And of course, when to bite our tongues. We're so happy you're with us. So let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Bite Your Tongue, the podcast. It's beginning to feel a lot like spring, so I hope everyone is enjoying it and getting out and enjoying this great weather. Before we get started, I do want to thank everyone who has already supported our podcast, but for those of you who are loving it and want to keep us going, please take a moment and visit our website at biteyourtonguepodcast.com. Look for the support button on the upper right side. And really, for as little as $5, you can give us some love. Now, business out of the way, let's get on to today's episode, which is going to be, I have to say, quite interesting. So let's get started. Today, we're chatting with Daniel Mate. He's an award-winning musical theater songwriter, educator, and the world's only mental chiropractor. He holds an MFA in musical theater writing from the Tisch School at NYU. So why are we chatting with him? Well, here's the scoop. One of our listeners heard Daniel on another podcast talking about his relationship with his father. His father is Gabor Mate, who's a very famous physician, public speaker, and author of 4 best-selling books on mind-body unity and child development issues. And now the two of them, father and son, are collaborating on a whole bunch of things related to parenting adult children, or I should say building healthy relationships with adult children. They have launched Hello Again, a fresh start for parents and their adult children. Under that umbrella, they have a workshop with the same name and some books in the works. Their website says that this will be the first book of its kind, written by a real-life parent and child, on the subject of parent-child relationships in adulthood. They also more recently collaborated on the New York Times best-selling book, The Myth of Normal. It's really an amazing book, very, very deep, hard to read, but boy, you get so much from it. And we'll get into that too. It resonated with me on a lot of levels. So we're very anxious to chat with Daniel and certainly hear more about Hello Again and everything they've been doing. I did spend a lot of time listening to some of their discussions on YouTube, and boy, they're very courageous in what they share. So welcome, Daniel. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself? And I guess I really want to know, how did you and your dad get into this? I mean, this whole idea of adult-parent relationships is rather new. I think I started one of the first podcasts. Then everyone was like, oh my gosh, this is such a talked-about topic now. How did you guys even come together to start doing this?
Yeah, well, in some ways, we've been in it our whole lives. Our relationship has always been sort of a flashpoint ever since I was a kid. And the more my dad got cognizant of and well-versed in and professionally known for talking about the topic of how parental emotional blind spots, let's say, or stresses affect their children in lifelong ways, then it was even more on the nose, in a sense, that our relationship would be something to reckon with, our history, our past, and me figuring myself out in adulthood. Obviously, a lot of things go back to that relationship, and that's just the physics of the thing, you know? And I think in the first part of my adulthood, I was just trying to figure myself out and dealing with a lot of sort of internal struggles and challenges, afflictions like depression, and just a lot of lulls in my life, a lot of ruts and inability to move forward. By the time I got to my 30s, I started making some moves towards a life that was more creatively self-expressed, more confident, but I was still dealing with the remnants of a childhood spent in a lot of defense, a lot of resistance, a lot of confusion about the boundaries between me and my parents. So that showed up in my personal relationships. And the more aware I became, sometimes things would flare up into my relationship with my parents because it would get more and more frustrating. In fact, for all of us, the more time goes on, the more distance is between us and the past. Why the hell does it keep showing up in the present all the time and coloring the future? So a sense of urgency starts to creep in, like, we're not going to be on this planet together forever. And there's something in us, I think in everyone, even though it can kind of get beaten down or beaten out of us or into a kind of flattened cynicism or resignation, that wants at some point to be able to really leave the past behind and to know each other in a way that honors the shared past. And I can talk in a bit about what makes this relationship so unique and why I think it's such a blind spot for people. I'm not surprised that people said to you, oh, wow, this is like a new topic. I mean, in fact, it's the most common topic in the world, but no one's talking about it. There are no books about it.
Right. When I was starting to come up with a podcast, I thought, what does everyone talk about? Mm-hmm. Their adult children. Anyway, go ahead.
What do all the adult children talk about? Their parents.
Right.
Or what do they conspicuously not talk about? And by not talking about it, the silence says a lot. Especially these days, there's a lot of adult children who have basically compartmentalized their parents out of their lives for reasons that to them are completely and totally practical and valid. They don't come by that decision lightly, but they've come to it. Anyway, we're not in that category. We're stuck together for better or for worse. We're not going to be estranged. We're not that kind of family. So, and I don't think that's better or worse, actually. It just is what it is. One of the things about this relationship, once you're an adult, your relationship with your parents is a choice. And once your kids are adults, your relationship with your kids is a choice. You no longer need each other in any sort of real way. It's an opportunity that carries with it risks and obligations and pitfalls and all that. And certainly there's something to be missed if it's not there, but it's not existential. I mean, we were going to choose it, period. Very tight-knit extended family and a lot of love and a lot of goodwill and a real active frustration with when we get stuck in ruts. And when frustration is active, it hasn't, you know, coalesced into a kind of resigned cynicism, then there's still, you know, fuel to actually work on something because it's like, God damn it, why can't we see each other? Why can't we know each other? So fast forward to around 2015, I was 40 years old, and someone who had seen us on stage together, or maybe I had cameoed at one of my dad's workshops at some retreat center, and she had happened to be in the room, and she thought there was something really electric about our chemistry together on stage, not because we were saying the exact same thing. In fact, for the opposite reason, because we were complimenting each other with a little bit of a spark, a little bit of friction, and that somehow we seemed to be willing or unable to not display the kinks in our relationship. That somehow with us, and you called it courage, people say that. Neither of us really relate to that word. Courage is doing something even when there's fear. And I don't think the fear really shows up for us as a pair. I have my own fears, I guess, and there are moments when I have to be courageous on stage with him. But mainly it's that way. It's actually kind of a deficiency on our part, but it's a happy one. We're unable to hide it. Like we're just the kind of family that has no capacity to suppress or hide anything. Everything leaks out. It's very obvious. And Dad and I are both public-facing people. I mean, I'm a songwriter, an artist, a theater artist, and I've always been very public. I've always been much more comfortable in places where I can share the deepest, most intimate things about myself than spaces socially or otherwise where I have to hide it somehow. So getting us together on stage to talk about this stuff, you didn't have to twist our arms at all. So we started a workshop in 2016. We've been doing it ever since. And then when we signed the book contract to write our first book, my dad's book, The Myth of Normal, which I co-authored, which is now a New York Times bestseller and doing great, we also signed up to write the Hello Again book, which is our next project.
Whew, there was a lot in that. So many questions come into my head.
There always is.
That's okay. So I'm going to say, you know, when I listen to your dad, he's, and I don't even know what words to use, esoteric, introspective. And you're a little bit like that too, but he's been doing this so much longer and he's well known for this. And even reading The Myth of Normal, oh my gosh, you know, you have to read it slowly, really, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. get it because it's pretty deep. So I guess I just wonder, as just my normal listeners, parents, adult kids, are they going to be able to go this deep to really figure out what's going on within their relationship? Number one, I want to add something to that, okay? your dad, and you mentioned it even in this, is really well known about talking about trauma. And when I think of trauma, I think of sexual abuse, anger. But when your dad talks about it, trauma can be small things in the relationship. So I want you to address, too, what kinds of things people should, you know, look at. Again, I think anyone who hears the word trauma thinks, well, my parents loved me. I didn't have any trauma.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your dad loved you and your mom loved you, but you had to work through trauma. So I want to get to that. And also just, can other people do what you guys have done? Because you guys are such deep thinkers.
Yeah, I understand. Let me take the second part first.
Okay.
Because I think actually an understanding of what is meant by trauma, and this is not just my dad's definition, but it is a slightly new one because for most people, because we think of trauma, as you said, as events, particularly horrible events that happen to some people and not others. War, famine, genocide, rape, sexual abuse, physical abuse, an alcoholic parent, a rancorous divorce, perhaps. Now, those are all traumatizing things. But if something is traumatizing, it's not the trauma. It's the thing that will most likely induce the trauma. So what is the trauma? The trauma is an internal wound that's sustained as a result of what happens. It's not the illegal tackle in the football game. It's the concussion. It's the thing that lasts. And concussions can happen by tripping on the street and hitting your head, or it can happen by someone hitting you over the head with a 2x4, you know? So just number one, it has nothing to do with whatever the parent did or didn't do necessarily. It's whatever the child internalized. Now, parents love their kids, period. Even some parents, I'd say even most parents who do things to their kids that you could call capital T traumas, there's some kind of love there. It's just confused and distorted, or they have a blind spot about their own narcissism or their own, the impact of their own, you know, how many alcoholic parents are there who don't love their kids? That's just, I don't think that's fair to say. You know, you could be a hardcore drug addict. You still love your kids. The problem is you're trapped inside of your own pain, which you're soothing with something. And that's the only option you currently have. Now, we can judge that if we want. I don't really see the utility in that. But whatever we can say about it, I don't think we can say in good faith, you don't love your kids because XYZ. Now, are there parents who actually aren't capable of feeling love towards their kids? Yes, probably. The most extremely damaged human beings don't have a capacity to love. But even that, you know, that just shows that something happened to them internally. So love is, I think we can assume that in most cases, love is there. But it's not about whether the love is there. It's about whether the love is received by the kid, because the kid has no capacity to read the parent's mind or heart. All the kid has, and kids are narcissists by right. They're supposed to be at that age, you know, 2, 3, 4, whatever. It's me, 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 which means if I'm not getting what I need, and what I need, it's just non-negotiable. Nature designed us this way, and it's pretty inconvenient to be born into the world we have now, because the world we have now, and this is the core thesis of the myth of normal, is not set up to provide these needs. In fact, in some ways, it's set up to frustrate them and thwart them. But if I don't get what I need, which is calm, attuned presence, unconditional love, the bandwidth and freedom to feel and express all of my emotions and to know myself and my gut feelings, if for any reason those are missing in a chronic way, that creates a threat for the child. And the child has to cope with that threat somehow. It's an existential threat, because attachment is the only thing that keeps mammalian young creatures alive, right? We can't fly on the first day. I mean, even birds can't fly on the first day of life, but horses can run on the first day of life, or at least totter along on four legs. We have to wait months and months and months before we can get anywhere near that level of strength and coordination. We will die, literally, without attachment. And that's a habit of the organism, not really a habit, but a drive that dies hard. It lasts all throughout childhood, but it starts to wane into the teenage years. And that's when we're negotiating kind of the final separation, the final emancipation from parents. But even then, you know, it's still contentious, which means that's a non-negotiable need. Now, if I'm not getting that non-negotiable need met, something's got to give. What's going to give? My relationship to myself. I'm going to get fractured inside in some way. I'm going to decide I'm bad, or this part of me is bad, so let me push it away. Maybe my anger, maybe my joy, maybe my sexuality, maybe my whatever it is. And then I'm going to forget it was ever there. So in other words, we become split inside. And that is the trauma. That's the lasting thing. Now, that can happen, yes, due to horrible events. It can also happen due to good things not happening. And good things cannot happen for all kinds of reasons having nothing to do with the parents' feelings, but that very much compromise the parents' ability to express those feelings in a context where the child can calmly and safely receive them. And that was certainly the case in my family, to the point where how my parents felt about me no longer mattered to me anymore. I didn't want to know how they felt. I wanted to know what were they able and willing to create as an environment and get across. And so I became very skeptical of and even cynical about my parents' feelings, because their feelings were the problem. Their feelings dominated my childhood environment. And so the wound was not that I saw that my parents didn't love me. It's that they acted in ways that violated that. And so, yeah, there's my, you know, so that's...
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
That part of the question in terms, I can, and if you want to say something, great, and then I can answer the other part of the question.
Yeah, I do want to say something to that because I don't want to get behind on my thoughts. I started putting myself, as you were speaking, into my role as a parent when my kids were growing up. Naturally, as you were speaking, I'm thinking. And now I'm thinking, okay, this is almost like a hamster wheel, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm 32, 33 years old, 34 years old, having my first child, all right? I'm still dealing with whatever it was my parents. I'm still growing in who I am while I'm trying to parent this next generation.
Of course.
I don't know that there's any perfect, we all have the best tools we have that we have to put to use.
Correct.
You know, just imagine this little wheel keep going around. How do we get to where we need to be?
Well, so that's called intergenerational trauma. That's how the things get passed down through no one's fault. Now, if we lived in a sane culture, this is why the subtitle of The Myth of Normal is Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. That's what we mean by toxic. It's not built for our wellness, because a culture that was built for our wellness, like the hunter-gatherer tribal societies we used to live in, or, you know, probably if you go back pre-modernity, I mean, look, no society is perfect. And ever since the dawn of civilization, there's been problems. Not to compare, but certainly the world we're living in today is built in a way that stresses parents, that has all kinds of catastrophic events that leave multi-generational effects, whether it's slavery or genocide or war or famine or mass migration, and where people are in some ways incentivized to suppress themselves, not just in their childhoods, but in their workplaces, in order to survive in social society where normal has become a toxic paradigm. And what makes it the most toxic is that it's invisible. So parents are laboring, doing yeoman's labor under very, very inhospitable conditions. So in no way is this about parent blaming. And if parents are listening to this, starting to feel defensive or on edge, I understand. That's the natural tendency. It's also not helpful, and it's certainly not what's intended here. So if anything I say comes through with a sort of edge, I can own that that's probably just my adult child talking, because I'm not even a parent, right? So I have the luxury of only speaking from one side of the coin. If I was a parent, I'm sure that it'd be a more well-rounded, but there's no blame intended at all. Parents do their best, and there are blind spots and there are objective constraints on parents' ability. Now, you could probably say that you pass less trauma onto your kids than you receive. That's usually the case.
Well, it's very funny. I used to say to myself when I was raising them, if I can get rid of 10%,
sure,
I would be taking a step. I had completely loving parents, wonderful parents. But as you know, everyone has their stuff they deal with. And I kept saying, okay, if I could just tell my daughter she's beautiful every day, you know, uh-huh. I mean, you know, find something that bothered me that I took to the other step, I felt like I was going forward. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that can become a trap of its own, because then you start trying to correct what your parents did, but then you sort of, your parenting becomes a reaction to your parents, which cannot be attuned to what this child needs, because this child isn't you.
That's exactly right.
But your point's well taken. And I often say to parents who are blaming themselves, I say, how old are you? I'm 50 years old. I say, how old were your parents when they started really looking at the effects of their trauma on you? They said, never. I said, exactly.
Right.
Back to the first part of your original question, which was, is it possible for other people? And then I have to back up and say, well, is what possible? Because if the goal is to become like the Mates, I would say it's not possible and it's not desirable. We're not here to be emulated. We're just going first into sort of uncharted territory. And actually, it turns out it's not so uncharted, because you're there too. But it's a big continent and we're all coming at it from different seaports. And we're mapping out some of the territory and we're trying to give people a framework that they can then look at themselves. So if you look at us on YouTube or whatever, or read what we're going to write about it, it could be tempting to be like, wow, there's so this and that. Well, A, we've been at it for a long time. B, the internal family culture of the Maté family has certain advantages. It also has a lot of drawbacks I wouldn't wish on anybody. So comparison period, including to whoever you're reading or listening to, is completely useless and counterproductive, and I would recommend against it. So then if it's not that, what is it? Well, the key thing is always in the subtitle. So I mentioned the subtitle of The Myth of Normal. The subtitle of Hello Again, the workshop and the upcoming book is A Fresh Start for Parents and Their Adult Children. Notice that we didn't say a happy ending for parents and their adult children, or you know, the final scene of a charming family comedy or something like that. No, a fresh start. Well, what does a fresh start look like for you? Everyone gets to decide that. Maybe a fresh start would be, let's not talk to each other for a couple of years, but let's not feel terrible about it. Maybe a fresh start would be, let's have a new conversation this Christmas that we've never had. Maybe a fresh start would be, let's look at the past. Let's have a day where we just hear each other and don't litigate, don't argue, don't engage in the same way. Let's break one pattern, just one. Wouldn't it be amazing to break one shitty pattern that you're sick of in this really core relationship? Anyone I ask that to, they're like, oh my God, that would be worth the price of admission. Well, then that's what it is. And of course, that's possible.
Yeah, that is. You're absolutely right.
The only reason it doesn't seem possible is A, you're overwhelmed by the enormity of the thing. And so you're imagining like it's all or nothing. And B, your eyes are dim. They cannot see. We have no, and this is where we come in. We have no ability to distinguish the individual components, the dynamics that are going on. And until you do, it's completely overwhelming. Like imagine standing in the middle of, I don't know, an ice hockey game without having, like you're put onto the ice and you've never heard of hockey before. You've never heard of ice, skating, pucks, or any, you would be absolutely, completely confused and disoriented and very scared. Well, this relationship can be like that. It goes by at such speed with such intensity. And for reasons that, again, I can sort of expand on, it's a completely unique relationship with a unique nervous system imprint, which will absolutely and totally dominate and own any of your conscious intentions until you make the nervous system imprint conscious. Because whatever you say you want to do or be in the relationship or whatever you plan to say, whoever you think you're being, that's not what's coming through. What's coming through is how your nervous system feels about this relationship. And especially for adult kids towards their parents, but inescapably the other way around too, this relationship is just imprinted on our bodies and brains and hearts in ways that just make everything else pale in comparison. So it's actually impossible to overstate the heroic challenge of taking on this relationship. And first you have to put on some glasses or some lenses, some bifocals to be able to see it more clearly. Oh, okay. I see. That's what's up. And that's all our workshop is. And that's what the book's going to be.
Well, I want to hear much more about the workshop and I'm going to get to that. But I guess I want to say to what you said there, I really agree with it. And I think what some parents feel is I gave 18 years of my life. I spent $100,000 getting this kid to 18 or whatever it is. I gave up blah, 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 blah. Now I just expect to have a good relationship. And really, you only have 18 years where you're quote unquote parenting. You might have another 40 or 50 where you're in a relationship. And your father said something about that. He mentioned, and it really stuck with me. He spoke about the role of parenting. And he said, most parents consider this the role of parenting, but really, when the child becomes an adult, it's no longer the role of parenting. It's a relationship. It's a real adult relationship. And you have to learn to transition to that. Can you elaborate anything on that and what he meant?
Sure. Well, I actually think he was saying something even further than that, which is that parenting isn't a role to begin with. It's a relationship. What matters in parenting is a relationship. I happen to think that that's kind of splitting hairs because I think it's both. I think that parenting is a function. It's not just developmental function. It's also a cultural function. We need parents. Parents are as parents do. And so in my view, sometimes my father places too much emphasis on the relational, I don't know, the touchy-feely side of things. I think that there's a very cut and dry kind of parenting is about doing something. Now, not doing it in a dry business-like way. The way you do it is through relating, but it is a role. If you're not cognizant of that, you're likely to get your eyes off the prize. Ultimately, I think he and I are saying the same thing. Often, as is the case, we speak a slightly different language about it. But yes, parents do get attached to, identified with the role, and not just the pure role, but whatever version of the role they've played, which is all mixed up with all of their emotional needs that they project onto their kids, all of their unmet needs from childhood, all of their illusions and filters about their kids. And then that becomes unfinished business. And there's a sense in which parents are like, no, wait a minute, we're not done here. Or they just like the role of being the go-to or whatever. Or some parents want to make restitution. They want to have a do-over. Unconsciously, it's like, I didn't get that right. So no, let me do it. No. At a certain point, that becomes developmentally inappropriate. So my dad's talking about letting go of that parenting role at the very latest by the time they become an adult. And that means also updating your operating system in terms of who they are, updating your view of your child. Now, I could say exactly the same thing for adult children towards their parents, but it's different. Updating your operating system to see them differently. It can't help but be different because the relationship is so unequal to begin with in every single way.
You think even as they become young adults, it still stays unequal?
Well, let me just put this scenario to you, okay? Imagine a relationship with another human being.
Okay.
Okay. One person chose to initiate the relationship by mandating that the other one exist. The other one had no choice in the matter because they didn't exist when the relationship was forged. The relationship was forged not in fact by choice, but by virtue of one of them, the second one arriving on the scene. When they arrived, the first one was 100% responsible for the second one. The first one was a fully grown human being, sentient, with a personality, a history, memories, a job, some kind of relationship, memories of childhood, all of that. They were at the very least a teen, and usually these days later than that. The other one was a blob of protoplasm without a sense of self. There was no I, there was no identity, just an organism who couldn't even control their bodily functions or emotions. Only under the care and supervision and nervous system co-regulation of the first person does the second person begin to become a person. Then, over the next, let's say, 18 years, nature's agenda is to produce a full-fledged human being, right? An adult citizen. By the time that happens, the 18-year-old has no daylight between them and their memories of childhood. Like, it's right there. The other one is now middle-aged with a lifetime of adult experience and regrets and foibles and catastrophes, and mortality is staring them in the face. You tell me how that's supposed to be equal, ever. I don't think equality is the point. I think maturity is, and I think present momentness is. But even if equality was the point, the thought that it would happen at age 18 is madness.
Well, not 18, not 18, right?
Okay, well, but then tell me what age, 30, 40?
I don't know.
In a perfect world, we'd have a culture again that has rites of passage, where it's not only up to the parents to raise the child, because the village would, the tribe would. And at a certain point, the parents would give it over to the larger world and say, you're on your own, or you're not on your own, you're now under the care of the larger community, right? So, but with the nuclear family, it's too close for comfort, too close for comfort, too close for comfort, for anyone's comfort, and then all of a sudden, go your own way, as Fleetwood Mac sang, right? So it's an impossible challenge for anyone, I think. It's actually impossible. And so in the way you sort of phrased that complaint from parents, I've put in 18 years of my life, I would say, yeah, that's what you're supposed to do.
I agree with you 100%. Yeah, that it's not your right.
I get that it was hard.
Right.
It
but you
hard.
Shouldn't expect anything in return. It's not like,
nope.
I agree with that.
Would it be nice to have a child who's grateful, who
yes.
can see you as a fully grown adult? Absolutely. That is the vision of how it could be if we lived in a world that was conducive to nature's agenda, which is to produce two fully grown, mature adults who understand each their place in the life cycle and in the community, who can then choose how to relate with each other. But there's so many wounds that we haven't grown out of by adulthood. And in this world, there's wounds that most people die with.
So let's get to where one of your interviews, you talked about relationships are not 50-50, they're 100-100. I want you to address that. And then I want you to talk about that song you wrote, Cutting the Cord, because I think that sort of switches, I don't want to say responsibility, but what the responsibility of the adult kid is too.
Yeah, sure.
The first part is the 50-50, 100-100.
Right. Well, I'm not sure if I quite said that. Relationships can be 50-50. You can have your relationship be 50-50 if you want it to be miserable.
Okay.
It's a choice. See, it's just an attitude, right? There's no, relationships are nothing. Like it's all made up. The question is, what's your story going to be? What's your approach going to be? What's your paradigm? If relationships are 50-50, then I'm always over here waiting for you to meet me at the 50-yard mark, the half line, center line. Not only that, I'm going to be probably overestimating how close to the center line I am. I'm always at 50% and you're somewhere at, you're just not meeting me. It's a two-way street. It's not a two-way street. It's a crowded market. It's a total free-for-all. So relationships are 50-50 is a setup for making someone else wrong and justifying oneself. It's a setup for upset and disappointment and then pretending like, well, I did my best, you know, and we get a payoff out of that. Human beings like to be right. We like to make others wrong. It sucks. It's miserable, but we don't see another alternative. The alternative that I'm proposing is relationships are 100-100. Well, what does that mean? It means I'm 100% responsible for how I experience the relationship, for what I express, what I don't express, what my boundaries are, how I view the other person. When you take that on, all of a sudden, something else becomes both available and incumbent upon you, right? There's enormous rewards. There's also enormous responsibilities. But actually, it's one step further than that. There is no 100-100. If it's 100-100, it's just 100, period. Because I have absolutely no control over, nor any diagnostic ability to assess how much you're giving 100 right now. That's your 100. Now, that doesn't mean a kind of psychological, spiritual bypass of, oh, it's all on me. Whatever they do is okay. I have to tolerate whatever. Not at all. It means that if I'm pissed off, if I'm at my limit, then that's just how it is for me. And I'm responsible for finding a way to frame that for myself and communicate it to you in a way that has integrity and that is aligned with what I actually want for the relationship and for my life. So even if that means setting boundaries, it would look differently from a 100-100 perspective than it would from a 50-50 perspective. 50-50 is impotent and powerless, and it's just frustrated waiting to happen.
I think you're right. Tell us about that song you wrote. I think you were about 25. You wrote a song called Cutting My Own Cord.
It was actually called My Own Man.
Oh, where did I get Cutting My Own Cord?
Well, that's one of the first lyrics.
Oh, that's one of the first lyrics. Okay. And you say something like, I will not be free until you make me free.
Well, until you, yeah. I'll give you the lyrics to the first.
Okay, sorry. Okay,
as far as I can remember. No, that's fine. This is back when I was like a guitar playing singer-songwriter before I started writing musical theater and giving my angst to fictional characters who aren't me, which I prefer. This is it. I'm cutting my own cord. My time with you has been a double-edged sword. I don't know what you mean to me anymore, but of this fact, I am sure that you were the disease and I won't let you be the cure. I can't tell if the problem was that we were too distant or too close. All I know is that I came home for a haven and I got diagnosed. And you can say you understand, say you want to be my friend, but I'm telling you to back off now and give me time to mend. Well, so far so good.
Yeah.
Actually, that's the sound of someone trying to assert boundaries in a clumsy way, maybe a sort of heavy-handed way, but he's doing his best. He really is. I think of it as like when you haven't learned boundaries, sometimes you can only set boundaries in fifth gear. You have to get your engine up so high so you can do it, and then you can hear yourself do it, and later you can learn how to do it with a bit more elegance and grace. But then the chorus revealed something unintentionally, looking back, about my blind spot about that and the dagger of recrimination and grievance that was hid in it. And moreover, the sort of self-handicapping, the self-sabotage in it, in the attitude, because the chorus goes, no, I don't have an explanation. This is something that I never planned. But this symbiotic incest of emotion, it's just got out of hand. Really catchy stuff, right?
No, I love it.
And there are things about me that you will never know, you'll never understand. And I will not be truly free until you give me time to be my own man. Now, again, I could translate that in good faith and say, what I'm begging you for, you guys, is some space. Now, I've only realized this recently. You know, the lyric says, I will not be free until you give me time to be. Well, that's, again, that's 50-50 stuff. And that's a recipe for staying stuck, as I did for many, many years. And these dynamics continue into the present. It was only a few weeks ago, really, maybe a month ago, that I realized.
Did you figure this out after you listened to it for a while, or did someone else point it out to you?
Oh, I only kind of thought about it again when we were preparing for that first workshop where I talked about it.
Okay.
Yeah, I sort of look back on it. But recently I realized something. It's neither true nor false. It's just, it's incomplete. Because it was valid for me to say, guys, I would love some emotional space. I need you to, what I was really saying was, I want you to understand what I'm going through. It would help me so much if you would have some patience and understanding for what I'm going through. That would help our relationship and it would help me heal. That's legitimate because it is a relationship. You can't always be super stoic and say, well, whatever you give me, you have to work with whatever they give you, but it's going to be easier or harder depending. What I realized is that parents cannot heal their children's wounds. And in a sense, that's what I was demanding in a sense. But what parents can do is be aware of what the wounds are, curious about them if they don't know what they are, humble about the fact that they don't know what they are, respectful of them in that you keep your distance when someone is wounded in a certain way. You don't go near that broken leg. You really give it space to heal. And then you become aware of the things that you might do or not do that help that wound stay reinfected or that give it the space to heal itself. And ultimately, that's what I was looking for. Those are the words I was looking for. But ultimately, a parent can accept or refuse that request, and ultimately, the adult child doesn't get to blame them for their inability to heal, even if my parents were the kind of parents that had no compassion for or patience for my healing process or whatever. It would still be on me to do it. I would just make some different choices.
Well, it was interesting because, and this YouTube I listened to might have been many years ago, because you said something like you are asking to be empowered.
Yes.
But did not want to take on the responsibility. And that's what struck me. It was like, again, your parents, you were putting it on them rather than taking the responsibility for yourself.
I agree, but I actually have come, that was in 2016, and I have I think I have a more nuanced and better faith appreciation for and empathy for the song, the kid who wrote that song now. I think I was kind of judging it. I think I might have been pandering to my dad a little bit when I said that, because that's certainly been one of my dad's complaints. When are you going to let me off the hook? When are you going to take responsibility for yourself? Blah, 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 blah. Yes. Okay. That was my blind spot. Sure. I was 23 or 24, overdeveloped in some ways, underdeveloped in others. And I was doing my best to express myself in a song. I was also depicting a particular mood or attitude in that. It's not like that was my I wasn't running for political office on that platform. It was just, you know, it was art.
No, I get it wasn't your platform.
But what I also see about it now is that there's an implicit request in it, or an implicit aspiration for myself, which maybe mistakenly thinks my parents have the power to emancipate me in some way, which ultimately, yeah, that is going to handicap me. But I don't think it was I'm not as dismissive about it now as I was back then. I get it. And I get the forcefulness of it. And I also get its limitations. It's just limited. That's it. So, a more mature iteration of it as I get older is, Dad, here's mom, Dad, here's who I am now. Here's what I'm still carrying. That's not your fault, but I'm telling you it's what I'm carrying. And now you are vested with the knowledge of what I'm carrying. And the fact is, this is also inescapable. And if you feel guilty about it, I'm sorry, I can't help you with it. I don't want you to. The fact is that historically, this wound will always bind me to the two of you, because forensically, your fingerprints are on it. There's no way around it. You were there at the scene of the quote unquote crime. It's not really a crime, but it was certainly an injury, mm-hmm. and an assault on my dignity, on my integrity, on my sense of self not in the sense that I was consciously attacked, which means now you know what your son is carrying and what your son is tending to and what can really easily get flared up in your presence. Even when I think about you, my nervous system can sometimes, you know, again, as I get older, I'm learning to navigate that with more grace and more resilience and more suppleness and more strength, ultimately, and to build new architecture around that wound so that it's not constantly open to your elements. But as I'm doing that, what I'm asking for is grace. And what I'm telling you, whether you agree or not, is I'm going to put that first over our relationship, even our current relationship, because there is no real relationship between you and me without me being me, without me remedially getting to know and becoming the person that I was born on this planet to you guys to become. And so I'm going to prioritize authenticity even over this attachment now, because the truth is we don't now, which doesn't mean I'm looking to dismiss you or you don't matter to me. You matter to me like crazy. It's just, if it came down to it, I'm in this life to become who I'm supposed to be. And so as long—
I was going to say, be your own person.
To be my own man, right?
Right.
So yeah, that was the, and that's the title of the song. So as always, you know, whenever someone says something to you that rankles you and you can see the flaw in it, it's very tempting to write off the whole thing. But there's a commitment behind that sort of erroneous message. There's a truth in it. And good faith relating, as a husband and a wife or spouse and spouse might do with each other, is listening for the commitment behind the words, not harping on the expression and our opinions about it. And between parents and adult kids, boy oh boy, is that hard to do.
And what's your view on son, father, daughter, father, mother? Is there any difference in terms of how that affects the different sex of the parents, sex of the kids? Any thoughts on that?
I don't have any take on that. You know, we've chosen not to focus on it. The maleness of the two of us is sort of incidental, or we try to make it incidental. Anything we talk about is applicable. Obviously, I'm sure there are different dynamics. Archetypically, there's different patterns in terms of the mythos of
right.
Father, daughter, father, son, all that kind of stuff. I'll leave that to the storytellers and the poets. You know, I think for us, whatever we want to put out there, I mean, we're not typically stereotypically masculine. We are in some ways, you know, but in other ways we're not. And so, because even if you were to talk about mother daughters, well, okay, then there's like Southern Belle mothers of lesbian daughters. I mean, there's a million different permutations, right? So
yeah, you're right. Okay, I really want to get into these workshops.
Yeah.
So you've been doing these for years and years. I go onto YouTube, I look at them. You've got 75,000 viewers on many of them, comments from hundreds and hundreds of people. What kind of trends do you see? I mean, here, my listeners are looking for what's going on out there. Why do you think, I mean, we all know why this is an important subject. Many times you ask questions to the audience. A couple of times I was able to hear the questions. Sometimes it was cut off before the questions came in. This workshop goes on over a couple of days. What they show on YouTube is just kind of the intro session. So what's happening in these workshops? What are you learning from the workshops that then you're going to hopefully put into your book? Hopefully, I guess you're gaining from the workshops. Give us kind of a upper level look at what this all is encompassed over the last 8 or 10 years you've been doing it.
So the workshop is quite participatory. Like you said, on the Friday nights, we tend to do a public talk with Q&As where most participants for the weekend come, but also other people who are not registered for the weekend. But if you're in the weekend, it's a full-on immersion into the topic with a smaller group.
Is it just the parents or the kids come too?
Oh, no. I mean, it's free-for-all. We have parents and adult kids.
Oh, okay.
They don't always come in pairs either.
That's what I wondered, if they're all together or not.
Anyone who is an adult kid or has an adult kid
okay. Can
come.
Or is an adult kid.
That's it.
Okay.
Right. And sometimes they come when the other person has died. You're still dealing with your relationship to the relationship. It's not just about let's fix the relationship. It's about how can I have more peace around this relationship?
Okay.
Which is hugely consequential to someone's peace of mind. I mean, people go to therapy for years to try and deal with this thing. At the very least, coming out of our workshop, you're going to have a transformed view of the trajectory of the relationship, of the history of it, which is going to change how you feel about it going forward. We kind of, it's 2 days long. We kind of structure it like the first day we deal with all of the obstacles. And the next day we start to piece together the opportunities or what might be possible. And really ultimately, as the subtitle suggests, like I said, the place we're driving towards is a fresh start. But as I say to people on the first morning, you're not ready for a fresh start because you can't see what's stale yet. So that's, we need to spend some time with that, really rigorously looking, which is why the first thing we do when they arrive is we separate them. You got to go sit somewhere else in the room. You don't sit together. We pair the room up. Hopefully, whoever's there as an, there's people who are there as parents, people who are there as adult kids. Sometimes people are there as both. But we try to pair someone with someone from the opposite cohort that they don't know. So if I'm there as a as an adult child, I'm going to sit next to someone who's there as a parent. And that's because throughout the day, we do what we call dyads, which are paired sharing. That's not really discussion. It's that one person shares for 5 minutes and the other one just listens. And then they switch and it's the same prompt. That's just a lot harder than it sounds. And it's transformative when people actually experience what it's like both to speak into listening that's not cluttered by someone else trying to correct them or defend themselves, just getting to really speak or learning what it's like to just listen. Whatever someone else is saying, even if you're triggered, putting your attention back on that person, that itself for people is sometimes worth the price of admission. But you have to experience it. It's not just a technique. It's actually a whole world of listening that we so rarely do in this relationship of all places. So the first day we look at the pitfalls in the relationship, really. I mean, first of all, we talk at more length about what I spoke about in terms of the kind of perilous uniqueness of this relationship and why that makes things so difficult. Why is this relationship different than all other relationships, we say as a sort of a little Passover reference. And then we move on to a dynamic we call prototypes, which is that in a sense, we're not even dealing with each other in this relationship when things are tense, which is for many people most of the time, either in a high key or low key way. We're dealing with characters. We are stuck in a character ourselves. The other person is stuck in their character. And we have certain prototypes that we've observed. And there are probably many others that we haven't, but we've sort of, I think we've covered a big swath of the repertoire with these. You know, there's the victim parent, there's the child parent who wants the child to take care of them, and there's the guilty parent. And for the adult children, the ones we have, there's another parent one, I forget. For the adult children, there's like the aggrieved child, which is one that I know very well. There's the dutiful child, right? Who's always there, but has resentment and fatigue and can't say no. There is the withdrawn child. So, and sometimes we often play songs to accompany them. So for the victim parent, we play Rose's Turn from the musical Gypsy. This time for me. Ethel Merman really captures the victim parent very, very well. And for the aggrieved child, we play that Metallica song that I mentioned in the 2016 workshop about, you know, dear mother, dear father, what is this hell you have put me through? And the point isn't that the prototypes are right and wrong, but they are constricting because when we're in them, we can only see and speak and hear through that filter. It's a totalizing kind of
right.
automatic box that we put ourselves in. We don't put ourselves in it. We're just in there. And then the other person's prototype shows up in reaction, and now you have a drama. And one of the facets of a drama that we talk about is that everybody but the two characters who are in the drama know that it's a drama. You know, it's actually pre-scripted, but they have no idea. To them, the stakes are sky high, and they can't step out of it unless it's like an absurdist play by like Ionesco or something. But then that's the exception that proves the rule, right? That's why those plays are so funny. But even then, they're trapped inside the play. So just getting to see, oh, what's my prototype? And it's not exclusive. Sometimes you can move through several of them.
So true.
But where do I tend to go? And how do I change when I'm in that prototype? What are the kinds of things I hear, I don't hear? What kinds of things do I say? What do I not say? Ultimately, I think all the prototypes are exaggerations of natural, authentic qualities. So the aggrieved child, that's a distortion. That's like a calcified version of healthy anger and a calcified version of grief. Underneath every grievance, there's a grief that hasn't been processed or felt. So if we can not make the prototypes wrong or try to pick a different one, God knows, but actually inquire into what is this prototype protecting me from inside, internally to me? What perception must I have about the other person? And as a result, about myself, Because let's say my perception of my dad is that he's a tyrant. And that is my ongoing perception. It's a persistent perception that I still can have these days. It's not how I walk around, but it's there under the surface waiting to be resurrected at any moment when I feel a certain way. Well, that's not really a view about my dad, is it? It's actually a view about me. I'm a helpless, small child who isn't heard and who's being suppressed, who doesn't have a voice. And therefore, in that drama, has to be a villain, and it's him. Now, there was a time when that was more or less, for all intents and purposes, true. I was 2 years old when he slapped me across the face because I didn't want to sing happy birthday to him. That happened. That's tyrannical behavior on the part of a parent. I remember the next morning when he brought me a piece of cake, apologized, and I phoned the entire extended family one by one to let them know that I had prevailed and I still didn't have to sing happy birthday.
Wait, I thought you said you were two.
Yeah, well, maybe three.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Three. It was before my brother was born. He was born when I was about 3 and a half. So
okay.
That was, for all intents and purposes, oppressive, authoritarian, tyrannical behavior. I don't think it's an exaggeration or hyperbole to use that language about it. But what made it so was the vast differential in power, size, and authority. I was three. I was tiny. Even yelling at me was an act of terrorism back then, much less hitting me across the face.
And at that time, was he an acclaimed psychologist and physician? And
well, first of all, he's never been a psychologist. He still isn't.
Right, right. That's right. He's a physician.
He's a physician.
You're right. Sorry.
He was acclaimed by his patients. He was beloved in his small East Side Vancouver practice. Yeah. I mean, back then, no, he wasn't very well known. He started getting more and more well known across Canada into my teens, first on the political scene because he was a rare Jew who was speaking out against Israel's crimes against the Palestinians back during the First Intifada in 1987, and thus he was pariah to the Jewish community, as my rabbi never stopped telling me. And then he wrote a medical column for the Globe and Mail and the Vancouver Sun. So, you know, and by the end of the 90s is when he wrote his first book, Scattered Minds. But look, I mean, he's only been a global celebrity for the past few years at most.
Wow. Well, he's risen quickly. So I just want to ask, any trends on the obstacles? You know, you've had so many of these and they raise their hands, I imagine, with questions. Mm-hmm. And what would you say are the significant trends you hear from workshop to workshop?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that from the perspective of the parents, guilt and resentment for that guilt is a very strong running theme. I mean, look, ultimately, it comes down to not being able to see each other and not being able to realize that the past is not happening now. That's the sort of the general answer. Parents often have their memory mm-hmm. of what happened to their child, but they're thinking about it through the filter of their parenting and how they experienced it, which is not, like I said, what the trauma is. The trauma is how it registered for the child. And often the parent hasn't really stopped their own internal monologue to say, how did my child experience it? What are they carrying, right? And when you get that, actually the guilt stops and curiosity starts.
Curiosity is a key word.
Key. And then when that happens, sometimes you'll be amazed at the person you're looking at. Like, wow, look at this resilient person who sustained that wound and is still here with me and wants to work on this relationship. Or I get it. You start to see them as a separate person, which is the prerequisite to any respectful relationship between two adults.
I love that.
Because the nature of this relationship in its dysfunctional form, which most people come to the workshop stuck in, is a blurring of boundaries, role reversal, confusion. I said to my dad when I was 9, I don't know where you end and I begin. I used those words.
You know, I read that. Yeah.
You know, not being able to tell reality from the story is another trend. I was abandoned is not a fact. It's a story. It's a narrative. What happened is my dad left, or my mom wasn't emotionally available. I got abandoned. I'm unlovable. These are interpretations and stories, and they're not invalid stories. But if we don't know that they're stories, then we're going to live as if they're the truth. Yeah, I'd say, and other trends are that parents and children have tried to change their habits behaviorally, but they haven't looked at the underlying emotional dynamics, and or they haven't found ways to create a shared intention together that can withstand the difficult moments. Because it's one thing to make up in the good moments and make a resolution, but you know how resolutions go in your own personal life, just with yourself. Now try doing that with the other person in this fractious relationship. So creating practices, habits, sort of scaffolding so that you can start to practice new behaviors so that you're called to be different. It's not just that you have to remember to be different, but actually the relationship, the container of the relationship changes. And then you start to get a taste for, oh, it could be like this. And I just have to refrain from doing that thing and remember this one thing and be willing to see you in a different way. And when I start to feel this way, realize, oh, I must be looking at you or myself through an out-of-date filter. Okay, I can do that. The minute you start to get a little taste of victory, you tend to want more. And then before you know it, you're dealing with bigger, better problems. And I heard it once said, trouble with human beings is not that we have problems, it's that we get stuck in the same shitty problems for too long. What we want is to have bigger, more challenging, more invigorating challenges, you know?
Well, and then you have grandkids.
Well, sure. And that's, again, that is a whole, and to be quite honest,
yeah,
very, very untypically, I would say, for people in my parents' age cohort, they don't have any. Neither me nor my siblings have kids. And that's, I think, a painful subtext in some ways in my family, because especially—
yeah, but it shouldn't be.
Well, I know it shouldn't be. I know it shouldn't be, yeah, but yeah. But I think my mother's grandmother clock is ticking. And I think she says she's gotten over it, like she's accepted that it might not happen. But I think it has been, I've certainly felt the weight of it, because in a family where it's understood that children learn about relationships from watching their parents, it's just been the case that none of my siblings or I have sort of really been in a position to have kids, including when I was married for 2 years. It just, I was completely deluded about what the prospects were. And that revealed something to me about my wounding.
But I have a real issue, I guess, on that, because I don't have any grandchildren either. I'm 66. And I really respect that it's my kids' opinion.
That's great.
This whole idea of your grandmother's clock ticking or whatever it is, that's not fair.
No, it's not.
And I don't think you ever want to put anyone in the position to have children who don't feel like they're ready, willing, or able, because it's an enormous job. I hate to call it a job, task, role, relationship,
yeah,
whatever you want to call it. I'm going to say that I'm glad you're talking about this, and I'm glad we're all talking about it, because I think it's been an issue for years and years that people have shoved under the rug and smiled and said, you know, yeah, we get along or whatever.
Maybe the biggest trend that I've seen, and again, it may sound like I'm waiting these observations about blind spots more to parents than to kids. And again, I'll cop to that. Adult kids have their own challenges to deal with. What parents don't realize is that their feelings about their kids, their wounds about their kids, their hurt feelings about their kids have nothing to do with their kids. Nothing. They pre-exist their kids. They're carrying it from their own childhoods, right? You're not going to take offense if someone says something, if on some level it doesn't cut you to the quick. That cutting you to the quick has something to do with a core wound that you're carrying. Now, kids are expert at triggering those things 100%, but the trigger is the smallest part of the gun. Whereas, what about the payload? What about the handle? What about the safety? What about the targeting system? So parents say, you make me feel this way. Well, first of all, that's never true of anyone. You don't make anyone feel anyway. But moreover, the upset that you're feeling, or the guilt, let's say, my dad will often ask someone, is that a familiar feeling? Yes. Can you remember a time in your life when you didn't feel guilty and responsible for everyone around you? No. How old were you when you first thought, discovered that you're responsible for everything? 5. Okay. Your kids have nothing to do with it, and you've been pinning that on them their entire lives, and they're sick of it. Now, by contrast, and here's the core inequality, your kids' wounds, like I said, have something to do with you. Now, they're not yours anymore. You can't do anything about them, except not to exacerbate them. They have to deal with it themselves. But unlike your wounds, you were around when theirs were sustained. So that's a big trend. That's a big blind spot. And when parents get that, the whole relationship transforms. And like I said, there's plenty of blind spots for the adult children too.
So I'm going to wrap it up right now. And we always wrap up. Well, first of all, I'm going to say before we wrap up, I look forward to your book.
Great.
And I have my fingers crossed that when it does come out, you and your dad will be a guest. I know you're going to be asked by a million other people, but I'm going to pray.
Look, no, this would be the I think this would, in terms of topic, the gold star invitation. That's so good. I'll make sure it happens.
Okay. Thanks, Daniel. Okay. So we always ask our guests to leave us with one, two, or three thoughts on that they really hope our listeners will take away from this conversation.
Well, I would say that for everybody, the first thought would be whatever you're feeling right now, it has very little to do with the present. It has to do with the past. Probably has to do with your childhood. Now, if you're the adult child, then your childhood, there's a strong connection between the person you're pissed off about now and the person who was there. But also remember, they're not the same person. Their cells have regenerated many, many times since then. But still, it is the same nervous system you're dealing with. If you're the parent, it's not even about that person, right? You're carrying your own stuff. So being responsible starts with being willing to say, my experience is my experience, and it's mine to tend to it, whether the other person understands it, gets it or not. And their ability to understand it and get it is also going to be correlated with how well can I express it in a way that isn't demanding of them that they make it go away. Because especially, I'm talking to the adult kids, parents will bristle at that so hard, or they'll take the bait and jump to the rescue and whatever, and that won't satisfy you, and then they'll feel hard done by, right? But until we learn to express ourselves in new ways, fresh ways, which is to say as adults, in updated ways, our parents will keep reacting to us in the same ways that pissed us off and wounded us in the first place. And then I would say to everybody, this is really hard, and you're doing something, I think, heroic by even engaging with it thoughtfully and wondering about what it could be like. And I think that's the most important thing, is to be able to wonder what else is possible. If we didn't make the way it is wrong, if we felt the grief, the sadness, the frustration of it, don't suppress the feelings, but to say, okay, if it could be any other way, not if we could be different people, but given who we are, what pattern would I like to experience life without? Or what's something new? What's something I'd like to create with this person? You know, having a project to do with my dad has been extremely good for our relationship, because the project was more important than being right.
That's exactly.
And it
right.
was even more important than the relationship in the abstract.
Right.
The relationship was being expressed and embodied by something not for us, for the world. And it's also meant that it's brought our conflicts to the fore. Every single time we do, we mark sort of a new leveling up in the collaboration, whether it was the day of the first workshop or 2 weeks ago, just as we're starting to write this book, we have some huge blowout. Don't make that wrong. It's not your fault. It's not their fault. It's for something. Something's being revealed. So why not choose to inquire into, okay, we just had a catastrophe. What lesson is it bringing? What is it exposing? Rather than using it as more evidence to burnish and solidify the story that's got you stuck in this pattern in the first place.
Well, I'm going to say, I think it's a blessing that you and your dad have gotten to work together. And my guess also is he now sees you as more of a collaborator and as an individual than just his son. So that helps too. So Daniel, I'm going to first urge my listeners to get The Myth of Normal, because that just sent me into the sky. And then you'll let us know when the book comes out, and I'll let listeners know about that too.
Can I plug a couple of other things?
Yeah, go ahead.
So two things for me to shamelessly plug. Number one, I work with people one-on-one doing something I call mental chiropractic, which you can read all about at my website, walkwithdaniel.com. It's done while walking, usually on the phone, because my clients are all over the world. But it's not therapy. It's a single event. It's a single walk where we get you unstuck on something in your life that you're stuck on. So this relationship is a frequent topic that people bring.
Interesting.
And I really enjoy that. And secondly, on a totally different note, I host a podcast of my own called Let's Get Lyrical with Carice and Daniel. It's all about song lyrics, because as you can tell, I'm a song lyric enthusiast. My co-host Carice is Carice Van Houten, the Dutch actress who played Melisandre in Game of Thrones. And every week we pick a different theme and talk about songs that embody it. So this week was, as we're recording it, the episode that came out today was about youth. And we did the Tom Waits song, I Don't Want to Grow Up, and Janice Ian at 17, and a bunch of other songs from rap and rock and modern pop. So it's a lot of fun. And you can find that wherever you get this podcast. Ours should also be there.
And I will also link it in our episode notes and in my e-blast I send everyone, because that sounds really interesting. I have a friend really into music who will love that. So I will share it with her.
Thanks, Denise.
Daniel, thanks again. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Same to you, Denise. Thanks.
Well, that's a wrap. Thank you so much, Daniel, for your time and insight. I'm so anxious to hear what each of you think of this episode and what you took away. It took me some time to understand everything Daniel was talking about and what it meant for me and my relationship regarding my own adult children. I really enjoyed so much of what he had to say. It got me thinking. If you have time to check out the workshops he does with his dad, I've linked them in the episode notes. Also, the book the two of them wrote together, the New York Times bestseller, The Myth of Normal. I've linked that also. I certainly look forward to chatting with Daniel and his dad when their book, Hello Again, is finally published. Thanks to all of you for listening, and thank you to Connie Gorant Fisher, our audio engineer. And remember, as always, sometimes you may just have to bite your tongue.